Welcome to Wall Street Unspun with your host, Peter Schiff.
But it's a giant bubble in search of a pin, and it's going to find
one. Are you confused with the ups and downs in the economy and what it means to you?
Don't believe the propaganda, and that's what it is. When you're listening to an analyst on a lot of these popular financial shows, you're not getting investment advice. You're getting propaganda.
Get ready to untangle the web of misinformation provided by the mainstream media.
These firms are trying to sell you stocks. Their real clients, their banking clients, are trying to get rid of stuff.
And now, here's your host of Wall Street Unspun, the president of Euro Pacific Capital and a licensed broker with a passion for truth. It's Wall Street Unspun with Peter Schiff.
Hi, everybody. Welcome again to another live edition of Wall Street Unspun, midweek market update. And there certainly is a lot to talk about. Every show now, a lot happens. Every week, it's amazing at how much stuff actually happens in the markets and with our government. And, of course, this week is in no exception. Anyway, I'll give out the number toll-free for questions. Not sure when I'll get to them, though. I know I have a lot to talk about again today. The number to call, 888-678-9597, 888-678-9597. We're doing the show now. It's live every Wednesday night at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific on my website, www.europac.net, and on shortwave radio, 5.07 megahertz. The show is now also available in podcast, so if you missed the live show, the show can be downloaded through iTunes and whatever these podcasts work, but now the show is available in that format. Also, I mentioned last time on the show that we were working on a video blog that's almost complete. I'll let you know when I will start doing blogging in that way. That way I can kind of comment on things a little bit more frequently. And you can sign up. I think you'll be able to sign up to receive emails of those blogs as soon as they are recorded. Or you'll be able to probably watch them on my site as well. Anyway, been doing a lot of television recently. I think yesterday I was actually on four times on four different shows. I was on CNN in the afternoon, and then again at 10 o'clock on Anderson Cooper. I was on Glenn Beck, and I was on CNBC. Hadn't been on CNBC in a while. I was on CNBC at 8 o'clock, a special show that they do, a live show on Is Your Money Safe? You know what my answer is. I guess all those shows will be on the website. Tomorrow, if you want to watch live, I have two appearances. I will be on CNBC again. Thursday at 11:30 a.m. Eastern Time. The show is called The Call, 11:30. I'm going to be talking about an op-ed that I wrote that is going to be in tomorrow's Washington Post. It should be online. It's a very good op-ed. I initially had the New York Times that had accepted it, and then they decided to reject it for some reason after they had accepted it. So we sent it over to Washington Post, and the Washington Post decided to run it. So that's coming out tomorrow. Also, I will be on CNN Headline News, Glenn Beck, again tomorrow at 7 p.m. Eastern. And, of course, they repeat it at 9 p.m. at midnight Eastern time, so it's on three times a day. Also, you know, I had another op-ed piece that came out in the San Diego Union-Tribune over the weekend. Good op-ed. If you have a chance to read it, I pointed out the moral hazard implicit in the housing bailout, where I believe that many, many people with mortgages are simply going to stop paying their mortgages because the government is now going to be rewarding people who don't pay their mortgages with a reduced mortgage. And there's no longer the threat of foreclosure for anybody who's living in a high-priced market with a home with no equity. But anyway, that article is also on my website. So I had two op-eds that came out, which was good. Anyway, a lot of crazy, crazy stuff happening in the market. First of all, what the Fed did over the weekend, new announcements that have come out. First of all, the government is requiring Fannie and Freddie to buy $40 billion per month of mortgages, of bad mortgages, non-performing mortgages, the troubled assets. So that's in addition to the $750 billion bailout. This is $40 billion a month, which if you annualize that, that's $500 billion over the next year that Freddie and Fannie are going to buy of, who knows what kind of value and how much they're going to overpay for these bad mortgages. So they're going to do that. Then, of course, over the weekend, the government probably, you know, they noticed that Morgan Stanley was about to go bankrupt, which was going to happen. I think Mitsubishi was going to pull out of their deal, and Morgan Stanley was headed for bankruptcy Friday afternoon. And so over the weekend, the government decided to bail out the banks again. They're going to divert $250 billion of the $750 billion they just got for the bailout to buy troubled assets, and they're going to take $250 billion of that money, and they're going to use it to buy stock, preferred stock, in private banks like Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, Citigroup, a number of companies. Now, one of the interesting things about it, and I'm putting the words interesting in quotes, is that the companies are required to sell preferred stock to the government, whether they want to or not. So obviously, again, this is more usurpation of power. This is deprivation of property without due process. There's no shareholder vote. The companies, the banks, are being forced to sell part of their company to the government. Now, they're doing it on pretty favorable terms because these are preferred shares where the coupon is 5%. So they're basically able to borrow huge amounts of money from the government at only 5%, which is a pretty good cost of capital as far as I'm concerned for these banks. But the principle is that they can force the banks to sell themselves to the government on unfavorable terms. They can force them to sell them pieces of themselves on unfavorable terms. It's the precedent that counts. But of course, again, I don't like the fact that they're doing it anyway. Even if the banks want the government has no authority to do this, even if the banks agree. Also, as part of this new bailout, the government is going to insure all bank loans. So if anybody loans money to a bank, I think it's a temporary basis, 2 or 3 years, but the U.S. government is going to insure those loans. So now banks can now borrow as if they were the U.S. Treasury, which is great because now people will loan to banks regardless of how risky these banks are, because now it's like loaning money to the federal government. Also, the government decided that they're going to insure all bank accounts in non-interest-bearing accounts, unlimited amounts of money. So if you've got $10 million in a bank and the bank fails and that money is in a non-interest-bearing account, then you have got 100% insurance on your money. And since, you know, overnight rates are so low right now, obviously people are going to move their deposits to the non-interest-bearing type. I mean, I'm certainly going to be doing that with my business account for my working capital. You know, now it doesn't matter how risky your institution is. If the institution fails, the government's going to make you whole. So again, that basically removes any market-based incentives for depositors to care at all about the institutions with which they're putting their money. So again, another moral hazard. All of this stuff, everything the government is doing, this is desperate measures. You know, what's happening is the government wants to put money in the banks so the banks can keep lending, right? But the banks don't have any money to lend because there's no savings there. So instead of acknowledging the fact that there's no money left and people can't go out and borrow money to buy cars anymore or buy whatever they want to buy, the government wants to put money in the banks and instruct the banks to make loans. Well, it's not that easy, right? In order to have legitimate credit, you need to have savings. That's what we need. We don't need liquidity. We need savings. But the government, the assumption that printing money is the equivalent of saving money, and that if you just print money and give it to banks, that we can all have an economy, that we can all go about buying stuff. And it doesn't work that way. If you could just print money and then people could spend it, then nobody would be poor. You know, there are plenty of trees in Africa. They can print money till their heart's content. It doesn't work. This is massive inflation the government is creating because they don't want to level with the American public and let them know the party's over. Let them know that, you know, the banks can't make loans because we don't have any more savings. We blew through our savings, you know, in the dot-com mania. We wasted our savings funding all these dot-coms. Then we tapped into the savings in the rest of the world to fund the housing bubble and the consumption binge. And now that we're defaulting on all those loans and we can't borrow any more money from abroad, now we're just printing it. And this is not going to help. And obviously, look, you know, the market, as soon as they announced that, we had the biggest one-day rise ever in the stock market. The Dow was up 900 and something points on that Monday. Of course, today, the Dow was down to 700 and change, the second biggest point drop ever, and the biggest percentage decline in a single day since the 1987 stock market crash. And in fact, I think this, this is amazing, the volatility here. I mean, the only time we've ever had rallies as big as yesterday, there were four, and they were all during the Great Depression, during the 1930s. But what the government is doing, of course, these are desperate measures, and it is not going to help the situation one bit. It is simply going to make it worse. You know, I got into a little bit of an argument on CNBC yesterday with an economist, Mark Zandi. And when I advocated that the government do nothing, you know, that the government allow this recession to run its course, Mark Zandi, in a classic way, accused me of trying to repeat the mistakes of the 1930s, saying that the reason that we had a depression was because Herbert Hoover did exactly what I'm forecasting, that Herbert Hoover did nothing, and because he did nothing, we had a depression. Now, that is the revisionist history that the big government advocates, the socialists, want everybody to believe, that we had a depression because of capitalism, because of laissez-faire, and that had Hoover intervened, that we wouldn't have had a depression. Well, nothing could be further from the truth. In fact, it is the exact opposite. It is precisely because Herbert Hoover did all the crazy things that Paulson and Bernanke are doing now that we had the Great Depression. It would have been a severe recession. Maybe it would have been a depression that lasted 1 or 2 years, but it wouldn't have been the Great Depression that spanned over a decade. It wouldn't have been nearly as bad. You know, Herbert Hoover, to give you a little background on this, you know, Herbert Hoover's Secretary of the Treasury, Andrew Mellon, he suggested what I was suggesting. He said that Hoover should have done nothing. He was the one that said, look, we have to allow the liquidation to take place and liquidate this and liquidate that. And Hoover said no. And Hoover said, and Hoover in many speeches, he talked about he was not going to buy into this the liquidationist theory, and that he wasn't going to stand by and watch companies be liquidated, watch people lose their savings. And so Herbert Hoover was the most activist president up until his office. Nobody had interfered in the market more than Herbert Hoover, prior to Hoover. In fact, most of the New Deal was originated by Hoover. Roosevelt really expanded a lot of the stuff that Hoover had already set in place. But Hoover stepped up to the plate. They initially tried to throw more credit at the economy to try to reflate the bubble. When that didn't work, they had all kinds of plans and gimmicks that they tried to interfere with market pricing, to prop some prices up, to keep certain prices from falling. They micromanaged the economy every step of the way, and everything that they did, you know, they propped up companies. Instead of letting them fail, they propped them up. They prevented the market from clearing all the imbalances. I mean, they interfered precisely the way we're doing it now, and it's complete, you know, sham to try to pretend that the depression was the result of leaving the market alone when it was the exact opposite. And in fact, even Bernanke, there was a speech he gave today in front of the club in New York, and somebody asked him about this again, and Bernanke made the same mistake, talking about how the mistake of the depression was that we didn't do enough. And he's got it completely up backwards. I also thought it was interesting in that speech, Bernanke said that, you know, they're going to study ways, they want to try to find out ways where the Fed can prevent, you know, asset bubbles from occurring, which I thought was completely ridiculous. You know, the way the Fed can stop asset bubbles is to stop blowing them up. You know, I mean, he's acting like, you know, there's some mysterious cause to the asset bubbles. Like there's no correlation between the monetary policy of the Fed and the asset bubbles. You know, they're going to try to study and try to figure out, you know, what the Fed might be able to do to prevent bubbles from happening in the future. You know, when the answer is very obvious, all they have to do to prevent bubbles is not to blow them up. But of course, you know, these guys are so clueless, they can't figure that out. Anyway, you know I want to talk a little bit about what's going on again with the accounts and the markets, because we're still considering to see our stocks getting beat up on a daily basis, and you know, people are still wondering how can these stocks be down to the extent that they are. I mean, you know, a lot of these stocks are now down 50%. A lot of accounts are down 40 to 50% right now. And people are like, well, how can that be? You know, I mean, obviously, these are accounts that started near the highs. And obviously, people that started years ago, the declines are not nearly that great, although they're down that much from their high point, right? But, you know, the idea is, hey, I thought these were conservative stocks. You know, why are they down so much? Well, I didn't think that they could go down this much, to be honest. I didn't think that these stocks would be beaten down to these ridiculous multiples. But that's what's happened. I mean, it's, you know, the stocks, you know, the utilities and the property trusts and stocks that you would normally consider to be a pretty conservative in that they wouldn't be high volatility stocks and they pay good dividends. Everything is getting sold and sold hard, and there's not a lot of buyers out there. And maybe a lot of these stocks, you know, people have been holding on to them to collect the dividends, but now they're just selling and there's no buyers. And again, what I look at is the prices for these stocks right now, and you look at your statement, what you're seeing really represents a fire sale price. What you're seeing is if you sell your stocks today, that's all you're going to get. It doesn't matter what the intrinsic value of these companies are. It doesn't matter how high the yield is. It doesn't matter how low the PE is. It doesn't matter. If you want to sell today, this is all you're going to get. It's almost like a foreclosure price. You know, if your house is in foreclosure, basically, they sell it on the courthouse steps to the person who can bring a cashier's check for the entire amount that day. Those are not normal circumstances for a real estate transaction. But under those type of circumstances, in a foreclosure, maybe they're going to get 40 cents on the dollar because they have to sell under those type of conditions. Well, I think those are the conditions right now in the stock market. People can't borrow money to buy stocks. No one's going on the margin. In fact, everybody's getting margin calls. Nobody has any real cash to buy stocks. I mean, a few people do, but they don't have a lot. Everybody's trying to get rid of stocks. And in that environment, if you want to sell a stock, you're not going to get what it's worth. It applies to everything. Because as I said, I'm seeing closed-end bond funds trading at 30-35% discounts to the value of the bonds, even though the bonds that they hold are double and triple A-rated bonds, and they're not in at all any kind of jeopardy. It's just that anything with a symbol, anything that anybody owns right now is being marked to a fire sale price. And I know it's painful to look at it because we're like, oh my God, this is what my stocks are worth. It's not what they're worth. Yes, that's what it's worth if you wanted to sell it today, right? But as long as you don't want to sell it today, I'm convinced these prices have absolutely nothing to do with what the stocks that we own are worth. I think under a normal market, when we get back to a normal market, under arm's length transactions, these stocks will have much more market value. In the meantime, the dividends are there. They're the same dividends that we were getting 6 months ago. They're a little bit different now because the dollar has actually gone up. So to the extent that we're collecting Australian dollar dividends, they obviously will translate into less money. But, you know, the Australian dollar dividends are still there. And again, I think this rise in the dollar makes absolutely no sense from a fundamental point of view. It certainly makes sense in a way from a trading point of view. I mean, I can come up with a reason to explain why the dollar is rising in this environment. I mean, I think it has to do with leverage players who have made bets against the dollar. But I also think it has to do with, you know, a lot of hedge funds, you know, were in foreign markets. A lot of mutual funds are in foreign markets. And they're all getting redemptions. And when they get redemptions, they have to write dollar checks. So they have to sell their foreign stocks, and they got to sell their foreign currencies. And they got to pay their margin calls in dollars. They got to pay back their redemptions in dollars. So there's temporarily a lot of demand for dollars. But that demand is not going to be here much longer once this liquidation is over with. Meanwhile, the Fed is getting ready to flood the system with newly created dollars. Trillions and trillions of them are going to be printed. And so there's no way that all these dollars can be printed and the dollar's value not ultimately collapse. You know, there's no way that we're going to be able to borrow these trillions of dollars from the world, especially now, after we've burned them so badly on the money they've already loaned us, to expect them to loan us all this money. So the only source of this funds is going to be from the printing press. And we know, you know, the Barack Obama, you know, they're having that debate. I think the debate is going on immediately after I do my show. But, you know, these guys are going to be promising, you know, more government spending. Now, we know, and I've been saying for years, on this show that I thought McCain or the Republicans would have no chance because I talked about how bad the economy would be by the time the election rolled around and that nobody would vote for four more years of Bush, which is basically what, McCain stands for, is four more years of Bush. But when Barack Obama comes in, we're going to be running annual budget deficits above $1 trillion. You know, $1 to $2 trillion a year in deficit spending. Now, where's that money going to come from? It's going to be printed. It's going to be printed. And maybe Obama will pass through a tax hike. But you know what? That tax hike is not going to raise any revenue. we're going to get less revenue despite higher taxes, because the only higher taxes are going to be on the entrepreneurs, on the people who actually might run a business and provide employment opportunities, and we're going to get less of those people. I think many people are going to be just taxed out of existence. Many people are just going to throw in the towel and shut down their businesses. And so the higher taxes that we're likely to see on the upper income people are likely to produce lower tax revenues for the government, more unemployed people, exacerbate the budget deficit, and so this is going to be abysmal. But in the meantime, you know, what's going on, I mentioned it, I think, in my most recent commentary, that what we're experiencing in the global markets is the collapse of the old economic order and the birth pains of the new one. Because right now the world doesn't really know what to make of the American bankruptcy. Again, everybody assumes that the whole world economy is going to be in a depression because America is collapsing. But they still haven't figured out that America's place in the global economy is a drain. We're not contributing. We're drawing from the global pot. We're not putting in. And to the extent that we simply stop consuming and borrowing, that is not a disaster for the rest of the world. It's actually a benefit. But obviously, in the short run, the world's lost a lot of their money. They blew a lot of their savings lending their money to us, and they're having to come to terms with that. And I think all this selling is spilling over. But I think ultimately, this is probably good for a lot of foreign markets, because if you have a lot of American mutual funds and hedge funds cashing out of all their foreign stocks and doing it at fire sale prices, then the rest of the world is getting their stock back at a great deal. And all they're doing is giving us our worthless dollars, or our soon-to-be worthless dollars. So in the short run, it might be painful to see the stocks this cheap. But in the long run, it's actually probably good for the world and bad for America, because these assets are moving out of American hands into foreign hands at fire sale prices. And so I think the buyers are getting the deal. The sellers are getting screwed. But that's what happens when you're highly leveraged. You know, when you're highly leveraged, you don't get to determine when you sell. The market determines when you sell. And right now, the market is forcing a lot of people to sell at a very, very inopportune time. The buyers, on the other hand, you know, they don't have to buy. They can choose to buy, which means they've got the upper hand, and they are able to negotiate right now very, very attractive prices on quality assets. And that is, in fact, what's happening. And that's why I still think that, you know, the strategy is correct to continue to buy these foreign stocks. Even though the prices are way down, I don't think it invalidates the fact that in the long run, this is the best place to preserve our wealth. Obviously, in the short run, it wasn't. Obviously, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, we would have been better off holding U.S. currency and just buying all the stocks right now. I mean, you know, if this is the bottom, which who knows if it is, if it's not the bottom, then we would be waiting, assuming that we had a crystal ball and we knew exactly where the bottom was. But the problem that I always had in my mind was, A, you don't know how much it's going to go down. And I'm surprised that we've gone down as much as we have. Particularly, I'm surprised that the dollar has been as strong as it has. I didn't think that it was going to be this strong. But given that this has happened, it still is impossible to know when the situation is going to turn around. And it's easy enough to sell and say, okay, I'm gonna step to the sidelines. Okay, when do you get back in? It's a lot easier said than done. And I've always thought that the problems are so huge and the danger to holding U.S. currency is so great that we're better off to just ride it out, which is the reason that we have these dividend-paying stocks, because I knew that the dividends would give us a staying power to ride it out, and I knew that if we weren't paying, you know, high multiples in general for fancy growth stocks, that would be okay. And a lot of people will think, well, gee, you know, a stock I own is down 50%. It's going to take me 6 or 7 years to get back to even. No, it's not. I don't think that's going to happen at all. I think that once normal circumstances return to the market, these prices will rise dramatically. This is not, you know, these stocks aren't down because their business has really eroded to the degree that it has. It is just because of the shareholders. I mean, in most cases, it's not that the companies themselves are in trouble. It's that the shareholders are in trouble, and they're having to sell their shares to raise money. And so the low prices reflect problems for the shareholders, not for the companies. Now, that's not true in every case, but I think it's true in most cases. And certainly, some of these companies are going to see their earnings suppressed in the current environment. But I think, again, that's also temporary, because the sales that are no longer going to be made to Americans will ultimately be made to somebody else. I think the real key is going to be when the Asian economies, particularly in China, when they really wake up to what's going on. I just read another article over the weekend that the Chinese government is trying to look into ways to increase domestic demand to offset the weakness in global demand. And they're going to try to double the income of the farmers, they said, over the next 7 years or so. And, you know, if they want to double the income of the farmers, it's not going to take 7 years. It would take 7 minutes. All they have to do is revalue the yuan, let their currency rise. And, you know, they still haven't put two and two together. They still don't understand that they can save themselves so long as they destroy us. But for some reason, they think that if they destroy our economy, that theirs is going to go down with it. And they're just wrong. It's just not going to happen. They'll liberate their economy. And actually, the best thing they can do for us in the long run is to destroy our phony economy in the short run. Because the sooner this phony economy collapses, the sooner we can rebuild a good one, a normal one, based on a foundation of savings and production. You know, the longer we try to maintain our phony economy and the longer the rest of the world finances it, the worse it is for everybody. But we, you know, the day of reckoning or the day of enlightenment or the day that a light bulb goes off in the heads of the rest of the world, it can't be too far off. It can't be too far off. I mean, it's all unraveling right now, and I don't think we'd be able to fool the world much longer. Anyway, I noticed we got some calls building up in the queue, so let me take a breath and take a Larry from Arizona.
Okay. My question is, what about the biotechnology stocks? They made a new high a few months back. They've gotten hit recently with everything else.
Yeah, you know, we don't have any biotech stocks. My experience with them is that they're highly speculative. They're, in many cases, like lottery tickets. You really need to know a lot about the companies, and they can blow up, you know, almost, you know, instantaneously on some bad ruling or a court decision. And they generally don't pay dividends, and they have high multiples. So they're not the kind of stocks that I would be comfortable holding through a bear market. So they're not even on my radar screen right now. But at some point in the future, we might look at them. But right now, you know, we're not even playing in that arena.
Well, you're right. They are dangerous. But if you buy a basket of them, if you date it back to like 1995,
yeah, but I look, it's just not, it's very, I would rather speculate right now in mining stocks and energy stocks. I mean, these stocks are trading for pennies on the dollar as far as I'm concerned. So why gamble on some biotech stock that may or may not even have income in the future when you can buy, you know, gold stocks continue to hit new multi-year lows, even though the price of gold is still, you know, $850 an ounce. And I'm buying gold stocks for cheaper than when gold was $250 an ounce. You know, oil's at $75 a barrel, but I'm buying oil stocks for prices that haven't existed since oil was $15 a barrel. So, you know, why play around with biotech when there's so much value in other things right now?
Okay.
Anyway, thanks for the call, Larry.
Okay, thanks.
Let me skip over to Matt in California.
Yeah, hi. My question is about 401k. I'm currently contributing 6%. To get a 3% match. But the fund options are limited. The management fees are high. Do you think I should?
Well, what are the options? You have some foreign funds?
I have one foreign fund, and it's charged a 2.5% fee.
Yeah, but I mean, if you don't contribute, you don't get the matching. And so the matching funds probably will more than cover the 2%.
Do you think that's better than going like with a Roth IRA and using one of your approaches? Or?
Well, you give up the matching. It would depend. I mean, I would try to do both. I mean, if it's a good foreign fund and your employer is going to give you money to contribute to it, it might be worthwhile. But if you do that, does that mean you can't do the IRA option? Does it preclude that?
I'm putting about an equal amount into a traditional Roth IRA.
Yeah, I mean, I would definitely go 100% foreign, or in your Roth. But you know, it's hard to pass up some of that matching funds if they've got a good place to put the money. If there's simply no good investments to be made there, then it's obviously not even worth it, because you'll simply lose the money you're putting in. So, in addition to the money your employer puts in.
Right, and I've been basically sidelined since 2003. So, do you think now's a pretty good time to get back in, or?
Well, yeah, I mean, some of the prices, I mean, you missed a lot of the upside between 2003 and 2007, but, you know, the collapse has been so dramatic in the last 6 months that in many cases, you know, you can get into stocks that were as cheap as they were back then. Some of them are even cheaper. So, as I said, I would definitely get out of the dollar and get into these foreign stocks. You know, not that I know if this is the bottom or not. I mean, I'm already surprised that they've fallen this much. So if they've fallen, you know, this much, they can certainly fall more. I mean, there's no rationality to it. It's totally irrational. The prices make no sense. But that can happen sometimes in the market on the downside and the upside. I mean, during the dot-com mania, you know, those prices made no sense to me either. I didn't pay them, but the prices kept going up, and I just, you know, eventually they collapsed. I didn't participate, and it's the same thing here. The prices are trading, stocks that I own for myself, for my clients, are trading at prices that make no sense. Now, I'm not going to sell my stock for these crazy prices, despite the fact, you know, other people are doing it. I mean, and I'm sure they don't want to do it. I mean, obviously they have to do it. Now, there is an exception. There are some people, and some of them are my clients, you know, and I feel badly, but there are people who are simply selling these stocks now because they've gone down so much, and the emotional reaction is, I better sell before they go to zero. When the reality is, the stocks aren't going to go to zero. These businesses aren't going to go away. You know, it doesn't mean that one stock couldn't go to zero. That's certainly possible. But if you got 30 or 40 stocks, you know, very few of them, if even any of them, are going to go to zero. But people get nervous. People get nervous when they see these low prices, and they think that, you know, it means that the companies are going to go broke. But in many cases, it simply means that, you know, the shareholders need to sell, and there's nobody that wants to buy right now, and that happens to be the price. You know, if we didn't price these things, I mean, if the stocks didn't trade on an exchange, if these were all private companies that we own shares in, and they didn't even list, then no people wouldn't even be worried, right? I mean, if we own these stocks, if every single stock that we owned as Euro Pacific Capital clients didn't trade, right? So it had no liquidity whatsoever. They were all private investments. We invested in partnerships, or we bought private companies, and there was no market. All we knew is that we were getting our dividends. Nobody would even be worried. Nobody would even care. There wouldn't even be any, nobody would even notice. But because the stocks are liquid, which is actually a benefit, now people are panicking because they don't like the price at which the shares are trading. But right, they wouldn't panic at all if they couldn't sell. If the stocks were completely illiquid, if it was a private company and you owned shares and we were getting our dividends, and there was no way to sell, then no, it wouldn't even be bothering anybody.
Right.
So it's kind of amazing. Because you have the ability to sell, people panic because other people are exercising that ability at a low price. But if nobody had the ability to sell, nobody would even be worried. Doesn't make any sense.
Okay, thanks. Hey, by the way, I love the book, Crash Proof. Just listened to it over the weekend.
Hey, great. You know, both my new book is out, too, Little Book of Bull Moves and Bear Markets. And for the past week, the Little Book has been number one in investments, and Crash Proof has been number two. So I've had the number one and number two investment books on Amazon. They've been very high, too. So I've never even seen an author have both number one and number two books simultaneously. So obviously, some people are discovering my books. And if you haven't gotten the new one is available online. It should be in the bookstores now. If you go to a bookstore and it's not there, that'd be crazy. I mean, they're putting all the gloom and doom type books in the front now, as far as I know. I mean, the bookstores have finally woken up to the fact that the markets are going down, that we're in a bear market, and that the economy is a mess. And I think, you know, we timed this little book very well. Because I wanted the book to come out in October of this year, because I thought the market would really be going down by this time period. Now, what I didn't expect was that the dollar, see, I thought the dollar was going to be going down too, and that gold would be breaking out. And so, you know, my book is called The Little Book of Bull Moves and Bear Markets, but so far, none of the bull moves that I forecast have actually taken price. So right now, it's pretty much, it's bear moves and bear markets. There's nothing that's working out. But again, you know, the bull moves that I forecast would happen, you know, I think will happen. It's just going to take a little bit longer for those bull moves to materialize. But from an investor standpoint, it's perfect for the people who are just buying the book for the first time, because they're getting to buy a lot of my stocks, like gold stocks and energy stocks and foreign value stocks. They're getting to come in at very, very good prices. So even if somebody has a total portfolio right now of U.S. stocks, right, and their portfolio is down 50%, right, they don't have to feel bad about selling it, because they can sell it and buy foreign stocks that are down just as much. But the beauty of it is, when the markets turn around, right? The foreign stocks are going to rally much faster. We've already seen that. The foreign stocks are going to rally twice as fast as the U.S. stocks. And eventually, I think the foreign markets are going to decouple, and foreign stocks are going to be able to go up, even as the U.S. market continues to go down. And that's ultimately what's going to happen. But right now, everything is coupled. And the reason that foreign stocks are going down more than U.S. stocks is because every time U.S. stocks go down, the dollar goes up. Now, how perverse is that, right? The weaker our market gets, if you watch the foreign currencies trade, you watch like the New Zealand dollar, the Australian dollar, every time the U.S. stock market starts to go down, they bash the Australian and New Zealand dollar. Every time the U.S. market goes up, those currencies shoot up. So it's exaggerating the volatility of the Australian New Zealand stocks, and the same thing with the euro. Our market goes down, up, down goes the euro. Our market goes up, up goes the euro. So that doesn't even make any sense. You know, as U.S. assets are losing their appeal, the dollar is gaining its appeal. So again, this is all craziness that's happening right now. Since we understand the big picture, and most people don't, we can keep our cool amid all this craziness. And amid all this craziness, we can take advantage of all the opportunities to buy more stocks, and we're not going to get fooled by the market into selling our stocks at ridiculously low prices. But anyway, thanks for the call, Matt. Let me skip to Peter in Massachusetts.
Hi. Got a question. Can you confirm who has the biggest gold reserves in the world?
Well, I think it's still the United States.
So isn't it...
But, I mean, it's hard to say because, you know, it's hard to believe what, you know, what the government says we've got in Fort Knox. I don't know if it's really audited.
Right.
But
well, since Nixon stopped the exchange from dollars to gold, weren't we able to kind of save our gold reserves?
Yeah, we lost a lot of gold in the late 1960s, and then we shut the gold window in 1971. But I'm not really sure what's happened to our reserves since then. But remember, see, we have hardly any foreign currency reserves. So our reserves, we only have about $50 million in foreign currency reserves. So we have more gold reserves, but we have really basically no foreign currency reserves. Whereas if you look around the world has trillions of dollars of foreign currency reserves. Now, they all have gold reserves as well. But they don't have. But the whole idea is we're supposed to have the gold behind our money, and everybody else uses the dollar to back their money. But this whole thing is a house of cards. It's going to collapse. But ultimately, we're going to need those gold reserves because we're going to have to go back to a gold-based monetary system. Otherwise, we're just going to never. There's going to be no end to this misery.
So isn't it in the best interest of the United States to kind of hike up gold prices and then suddenly...
Well, no, because the government doesn't want that to happen because the government wants people to have confidence in the dollar because they're holding the dollar as a reserve. And if you see a huge increase in the price of gold, that shows the world that the dollar is losing value and it'll hasten the move away from the dollar as a reserve currency. So, no, the government wants gold to be low. Because they need gold to be low to fool the world into thinking the dollar is still sound when the dollar is not sound at all. It's anything but sound.
But wouldn't we be able to pay off all our debts in a jiffy? Like,
no, I don't. I'm not. You're losing me in your.
Well, we
do have gold, but we don't have nearly enough.
Okay. And one more question about those $40 billion a month for. Buying mortgages?
That's Fannie and Freddie, yeah.
Are house prices from coming down?
No, it's not going to stop them from coming down. They're still going to come down. It will slow the decline. But the problem is, see, all they're doing is buying up existing mortgages. But it doesn't mean that if somebody wants to buy a house, the brand new mortgages are still a lot harder to get, and the rates are higher. So people still can't buy homes. People still can't afford homes. Plus, remember, people are losing their wealth. People are losing their jobs. The stock market is collapsing. The stock market is back down to where it was 10, 11 years ago. People actually have household income now, I think, is lower than it was 10 years ago. Meanwhile, you know, food is a lot more expensive. Energy is a lot more expensive. So American people are a lot poorer today than they were 10 years ago. Therefore, they can't afford to pay as much for houses as they could 10 years ago, which means prices for houses have to plunge to reflect the new reality that the Americans who could potentially buy those houses are broke.
Yeah.
So this is going to slow the rate of decline, but it's not going to change the fact that prices are going to go down dramatically.
Right. Well, unfortunately, what I'm worried about now that the government has control of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, they can actually use that as a mechanism to fuel reading.
Well, yes, now that they've got control of them, they are doing, they're acting even more irresponsibly than when they didn't have control. But the thing is, they're not going to reflate the bubble. Housing prices still have to keep falling. I mean, that, you know, people keep talking about we have to stabilize housing prices. Well, we can't because they're too high. You can't stabilize them at an artificially high price. See, people go back to the bubble and think that, oh, that's the normal home price. We need to keep those high home prices. That wasn't normal. That was the problem. That was the fantasy. That was the bubble. Home prices need to be a lot lower. Now, a lot of people don't want to admit that because a lot of Americans, right, their only asset is their home. And they were conditioned to think, this is my wealth. My wealth is my home. And they don't want to accept the fact that your home is worth, you know, a half or a third of what you thought it was, because it means they're broke. So they want to go back to this high home price. They want the government to push home prices back up so they can get that money back. But they can't. They never really had it. It was an illusion. They bought into nonsense. They bought into an hysteria. And a lot of Americans don't want to admit the fact that they are completely broke. And, you know, it's another thing from an interesting point of view. People are saying, well, what if the accounts don't come back? What if our accounts stay at this level and they don't come back to where they were? Well, I don't think that's going to happen. But I think the only way that can happen is if it is massive deflation all the way around. Okay? Massive deflation. And what would happen then is real estate prices would probably drop by 70 or 80%. Food prices would drop dramatically. The price of everything you need to buy would collapse. And so, in a relative sense, you wouldn't be any worse off than before the stocks went down. Because even though you would have less wealth, everything you wanted to buy would be a lot cheaper. It would be a massive deflation. If we didn't have the collapse of the dollar and the inflation that I forecast, and instead the price of everything is adjusted down, I mean, wages will go down. I mean, wages will collapse in that environment. So people who are earning $50,000 a year right now, in a few years, they'll be earning $20,000 a year. So everybody's wage scale is going to go down. All the prices are going to go down. I mean, college tuitions will collapse. Home prices will collapse. The price of everything will just collapse. And in which case, even though your account with me is half what it was, you still might be better off. Now, I don't think that's going to happen because we're such a big debtor nation that the federal government can't sit back and allow a massive deflation to occur, because that $9 or $10 trillion national debt that we have, if there was a massive deflation, that $9 or $10 trillion could feel like $20 trillion or $30 trillion. And so when you have this much debt and all these debtors, and when I look at the monetary policy, there's just no way the government is going to allow this economy to deflate, and they are going to print and print and print and print and print, which they're already doing, which means it guarantees they wipe out the dollar. And so instead of all the prices collapsing, all the prices go up, and in which case our stocks, of course, will go up a lot more. Anyway, let me hop to the next question, but thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Who am I on? Was that Peter from Massachusetts, or is Peter still holding?
This is Mary. Can you hear me?
Oh, hey, Mary. I'm Mary in California. How are you, Mary?
I'm fine. Thanks for taking my call. I had a couple of questions relating to the Japanese market and wanting to stay in cash for a while. I was wondering, once the carry trade unwinds, or close to it being totally unwound, what do you think the dollar-yen ratio is going to be? I remember the night before Bear Stearns was going to collapse and before the Fed stepped in, I saw some sort of headline that the yen dropped down to 85.
Yeah, the yen's been the strongest currency in the world, and I think to the extent that somebody wants to just ride this out in cash, right, it seems like the yen is the cash to be in because it's stronger than the dollar, and ultimately it's the dollar that's going to collapse, not the yen. So if you really want to be in cash because you just can't handle volatility, the yen seems like it's the way to go. And
Arla, believe me, I have plenty of stocks. I have some cash, and I put it in yen about 6 months ago, and I was wondering, once the carry trade unwinds, what would that ratio be?
I don't know. I mean, I think the yen's going a lot higher. I can't tell you what it's going to be. The carry trade is already unwinding.
Yeah, I know, but how low is it going to go? I mean, is it going to go to 50? Is it going to go to 50?
I can't believe there's that many people still left in the carry trade because they're all on margin, and I can't imagine there's many people left doing it because they would have been blown out of the water based on the recent action with the funding currency, the yen, going up, and the carry currencies, the Australia, the New Zealand dollar, you know, getting crushed. So I don't know how many players are still in that trade. I think eventually the bigger trade is going to be the snapback from the unwinding.
Well,
but ultimately, you know, I think the Asian currencies are going to be the strongest currencies in the world because they've got the fundamentally soundest economies, including the yen.
Yeah, but once it unwinds, though, or once it's, even if it might be there yet, you know what, somehow I think Japan's going to screw it up, and I'm wondering, should I change to a different currency? Should I put it in maybe the Hong Kong dollar?
Look, I don't know. I mean, look, I like the Singapore dollar also as an Asian currency. You know? And, you know, for the European currencies, if you're going to be in cash, I like the Swiss franc. The Swiss franc has gone down, but it's gone up against the euro, so it's held on, you know, better than the euro.
So you think that the yen is better to be in than, say, the Hong Kong dollar?
Well, the Hong Kong dollar is another currency that you can be in because it's pegged to the U.S. dollar. It doesn't even change. So
I know,
but eventually, I think that they
should
will float
I,
the
should
Hong
I
Kong
go
dollar.
There
it will go way up. So the Hong Kong dollar, to me, is kind of like you can't lose kind of situation the way I look at it, because the Hong Kong dollar is not going to go down, but eventually it's going to go up. But for the last, you know, how many years, it hasn't done anything. It's just pegged to the U.S. dollar, which means that during the years where the U.S. dollar was losing value, the Hong Kong dollar was losing value. That's why Hong Kong was experiencing very high inflation, because their currency was not allowed to rise. Now that a lot of currencies are falling, you know, the Hong Kong, you know, the dollar is rising now. The Hong Kong dollar is strengthening against the euro, for example.
Right. I just figured that once the carry trade unwinds and there's no more gain against the dollar or the Hong Kong dollar, should I switch and...
Don't know when that's true. But, I don't think you should keep all your money in the yen. I think you should be taking advantage of the bargains that are out there in these high-yielding foreign stocks, because when you own the yen, your dividend, your yield is basically zero. You can't get any return on it. So it's like stuffing money in a mattress. You know, you can't invest, you're not going to get a return. You're just holding on to a currency in your mattress. So long term, I don't think that's the way to get investment income. You need to have the money working. But in the short run, just to preserve purchasing power, I think it's a better alternative than holding U.S. currency, which is like playing with a ticking time bomb. I mean, there are a lot of people that are playing it safe. They think they're playing it safe. They're on the sidelines with dollars, and one day they're just going to wake up broke. And that's the real risk there. Anyway, thank you for the call, Mary.
Thanks.
Keep on going to Julia in New York.
Hi, Peter. I want to tell you I'm a really big fan.
Thank you.
And the question I have, you mentioned commodities often, but it's usually oil or precious metals. I'm a dairy farmer. How do you see the overall commodity market performing in a hyperinflationary
state? Well, look, I'm bullish on commodities in general, and I think that farming in the United States is a good industry to be in. Especially with the potential for export. So, I mean, I think that, you know, long term that we're going to do well. In fact, I think that we're still in a bull market in commodities. I think, you know, commodities have been in a bull market for 8 years. This is clearly a correction in that bull market that we're having in commodities. It's a very severe correction. It's a violent correction. But I think the bull market is going to live on for many, many more years. In contrast, I think the U.S. market has been in a bear market for 8 years, and I think this decline will continue. I think what we saw in the U.S. market between 2002 or 3 and 2006 was a bear market rally. And so I think the primary trend for U.S. stocks is down. But I also think we are in bull markets in commodities, and we are in bull markets in many foreign markets. They've been in bull markets, for 8 years or so, or 5 years. And I think these are corrections in bull markets. They are very severe corrections. But ultimately, I think that's what we're seeing. And I still think that there's a lot of upside in the global economy. You know, people look at me and they say, oh, Peter's Dr. Doom. He's all negative. He's gloom and doom. I'm not negative on the world. I'm negative on the U.S. for good reason. But I am very positive on what it means for the world to no longer have to support the United States. I understand how expensive it's been for the world to prop us up, how much money they've had to loan us, how much of their resources and how much of their goods they've had to set aside for us. And when they no longer have to do that, it's like I have the analogy in my book, you know, in serfdom, there was the serfs and there were the lords. And the serfs were required to turn over 25% of their productivity to the lords. Now, the fact that the lords exacted that tribute didn't benefit the serfs, But that's the same situation that the world is in with the United States. It's a giant serfdom where we're requiring the rest of the world to turn over their productivity to us. And I think that, you know, when they have this revolution and they enough is enough, that the world is going to be on much sounder footing and they're going to experience greater prosperity when they can claim 100% of their productivity instead of having to, you know, give so much of it to us.
Well, you know, the strange thing was last year, all the USDA reports, milk was historically high for farmers. And they said that the increase was due to the Chinese liked cheese, and that was why the price was up. But now this fall, it's down. You know, so I don't understand it. The dollar's weak. Did the Chinese lose their appetite for cheese? You know, I can't
understand. I'm having a hard time hearing you talk. So I think you might have asked me about, you know, why the dollar or the demand falling out of China. And it might be on the margin, but I don't think that's going to continue. I think there's going to be continued growth and improvement in the Chinese economy, and ultimately domestic demand will continue to grow in China, despite the fact that export demand from America is slowing. I think it'll be more than offset by export demand in other emerging economies as well as domestic demand. But anyway, thank you for the call. I'm having a real hard time hearing you.
Can you
let
now?
Me skip. Well, anyway, let me just skip on because I don't want to take too much time. Anyway, I won't call. I'm running out of time here. I got 10 minutes left. So I got two more calls. Let me skip to John in California.
Hey, Peter, how you doing?
Okay.
Hey, just a thought. I don't believe at all that there's any gold in Fort Knox there. I think that's just a bunch of bull there. But as far as the interest rates, you know, and our interest rate being so low, do you think people are going to pull money out of, you know, the U.S. with the low interest rate and head over to Europe?
Look, eventually they will. I mean, right now, I mean, perversely, money is pouring into the U.S. Treasury market. You know, even though the short-term money is paying like a quarter of 1%, people are still loaning to the U.S. government because they think it's safe. And of course, it's not safe at all. But, you know, I have been noticing that long-term interest rates have been edging higher. They're still low, but they've been hedging higher. So the yield curve has been steepening. And ultimately, you know, it's gonna get steeper and steeper and steeper. And eventually, the long end of the curve is going to collapse. That has to happen because of the massive amount of inflation the Fed is creating.
Right. Okay, thank you so much, Peter.
All right, thanks. Let me see. Last caller for the night will be Eugene in California.
Hey, Peter. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a big fan, and I've actually been thinking about investing in gold. I've been short the market for a while, and I actually had two questions about investing into gold. The first one, I've read a lot of discussions. I was looking at actually buying GLD. And I've read a lot of discussions about the difference between the paper market and the physical market in gold. And there's a lot of people arguing that actually right now gold is being sold for physical gold. Is actually being sold for 100 over spot. And the paper market is actually being manipulated in a lot of ways.
I don't know. I hadn't heard that. I know there's a lot of demand for physical and a lot of places that sell coins are running low on inventory. And, you know, but I don't think people would be foolish enough to pay $100 over spot. But there are a lot of ways that, you know, bigger players invest in gold through things like GLD. And so there's some big money playing around in that market. And obviously, if there's some big margin calls among the hedge funds, you know, if the hedge funds own gold, they don't buy bullion. They buy things like GLD. And if they're getting margin calls, then they're selling GLD. So maybe what's happening is you've got in the individual retail market, there's a lot of demand for gold coins as a hedge. But among the big institutions, there's more selling going on. And I think that's a temporary situation. And ultimately, I think the institutions are going to turn into buyers and the price is going to go up. But I think, you know, I think right now, you know, you can certainly buy GLD, you know, and there's plenty of upside once you know this liquid, you know, these market related, you know, selling is overcome by fundamental buying, and ultimately I think that is what's going to happen. But you know, I still like owning the physical, and I like owning it at Perth Mint. You know, having your metals on deposit outside the United States, because I don't trust the government of the United States one bit. I think they're going to nationalize or make it illegal to own gold, and I think you might want to have your gold in Australia, just so you know you have it. And if you ever want to leave the country, you know that there's some gold waiting for you on the plane. Hello? All right, I don't know what happened there. Anyway, I was not on the air. But anyway, so we only got about 5 minutes left. We had a little technical problem. But look, if anybody is out there listening and you haven't opened up an account yet with Euro Pacific, I mean, what a fantastic opportunity to put money to work. And I said, even if you're in a situation where you've been fully invested in U.S. stocks and you're thinking, I can't sell now, my stocks are down 50% or more than that, I can't get out. Yes, you can. You can get out of U.S. stocks and you can move laterally into foreign stocks because they're all down. The whole world, every stock in every market in every country is down. It doesn't matter what the industry is. It doesn't matter what they do. There is nothing in the world with a symbol that has gone up. Everything has gone down, and not a little, a lot. So just because you're taking a huge loss on your U.S. stocks doesn't mean that you can't make it up in a foreign stock. And, you know, you can sell your U.S. stocks that are still trading at 20 and 30 times trailing earnings and buy a stock in around the world trading for well under 5 times earnings. You can sell your U.S. stocks that are paying no dividends and buy foreign stocks with 10 and 20 and 30% dividends. And you can get out of dollars and into other currencies at the same time. You know, so it's a great time to make this move, but you got to act quickly, I think, because at some point we're going to see a decoupling of these markets, and the foreign markets are going to rise, and they're not going to be the value that they are right now. And then if you have to sell your U.S. stocks for practically nothing to buy foreign stocks, you're not going to be able to preserve anywhere near as much as the purchasing power you can preserve by making these kind of moves now. And I think if you're a Euro Pacific Capital client and, you know, you've got a lot of U.S. stocks still in your other brokerage accounts, again, I think it's a time to move more money out of U.S. into the foreign markets. If the markets go up, even if the U.S. market goes up, based on what I'm observing, the foreign market should go up a lot faster. And if the U.S. market goes up, the dollar will probably go down. That's how it's been trading. But eventually, I think the U.S. markets will go down and the dollar will go down too. And eventually, I think foreign markets will stop following the U.S. market down and they will, in fact, be able to go up. It's not happening right now. Right now, all these financial markets are joined at the hip. But I don't think that's the case for the economies. And I don't think foreign economies are anywhere near in as bad a shape as the media portrays. And I don't think they're anywhere near in as bad a shape as the U.S. economy. I'm tired of hearing people talk about how it's so much worse every place else. It's not. It's not worse every place else. It's worse here. And people have to remember, the reason that other countries are in trouble is because they loaned us money and we're too broke to pay it back. There's a big difference. You know, Norway just passed the $50 billion bailout. The Norwegian government is going to be buying $50 billion of mortgages off new Norwegian banks. But you know what? These aren't mortgages from Norwegian citizens on Norwegian property. These are U.S. mortgages. This is money that they loaned us. This is money that Norwegian institutions loaned to American citizens to buy houses in America. So if you think Americans are pissed off about the bailout, think about what the Norwegians must be thinking, that the government is using taxpayer money to buy mortgages from Americans. But anyway, we infected the whole world. It's our economy that's screwed up. We're the ones that are living beyond our means. We're the ones that are recklessly consuming and borrowing. We're the ones that aren't saving and aren't producing. It's our phony economy that's going to topple, and it's going to liberate the rest of the world. Anyway, take advantage of the craziness and other people's stupidity and foolishness while you can, because these prices will not last long. Anyway, I will be back again next week for another live episode of Wall Street Unspun. This has been Peter Schiff from Euro Pacific Capital, author of Crash Proof and the little book of bull moves in bear markets.